It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's being called the most significant criminal justice reforms by the Iowa legislature in many years. Legislation passed by the Iowa legislature. It's awaiting the governor's signature. It would reduce prison terms for some inmates at the Iowa State Penitentiary and other state penal institutions. And these measures are also thought that they will help save taxpayer money while keeping Iowa safe. Another aspect, in January, Governor Branstad and the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court urged lawmakers to take a fresh look at criminal sentencing reform in light of the fact that nearly 10% of the black men in Iowa are either in prison or on parole. Only two other states have higher percentages of black prisoners. So one of the questions we'll be looking at this hour, will this new legislation also lessen Iowa's disproportionately minority prison population? A few of the questions we'll be looking at, and we'd like to have you join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Joining us, first of all, to give us an overview and his thoughts, Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller in our Des Moines studio. Attorney General Miller, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Let's have you explain some of the legs on this stool here. For the first time in 4 years, the Iowa legislature has passed this bill that will reduce penalties for felons. It passed the Iowa House, the Iowa Senate last week, awaiting the governor's signature. Tell us more about the key provisions.
Well, it's pretty simple in a way. It applies to drug offenses where there are mandatory minimum sentences that must be served, and it doesn't change the sentence. But what it does is give some more power to the parole board, who, by the way, have done an excellent job in making calls like this for some time now. So when someone has served a half of their mandatory minimum, then the parole board can release them as long as they're not a high-risk person based on their assessments, which they do with the Department of Corrections, and they're very good assessments. So if someone is not high-risk, then they can be released. But, you know, they're not released all at once. They would be released probably on work release or some other intermediary kind of sanction or facility. And they would only be released when the parole board has made a judgment that that they don't provide a risk to the safety of others. Mm-hmm. The result of this is that people that could be safely released are released and don't serve years beyond what's really necessary to protect the safety of Iowans.
So tell us in sort of concrete examples, what sort of crimes would fall into that category?
The basic possession and delivery of relatively small amounts would fit into the categories.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you went on record as supporting this bill a few weeks ago. What made you support it? Go on record for that.
Well, it's a bill that we've worked on for months, frankly, in the Attorney General's office. At the end of last year, we thought that it was a time for some form of sentencing reform. That there were people serving longer sentences than they need to serve in terms of safety. That we were spending more money than we needed to spend on these individuals. Mm-hmm. And if it was done right, they would have a better chance of doing what's right and heading in the right course of their life with the appropriate people being released. So we worked up a couple of different proposals. We had a number of meetings with the Department of Corrections, who just do a terrific job on these issues. Then we also had some contact with the parole board, and once getting comfortable with some positions, then we went to the governor's office, and the governor signed off on this particular legislation. Then we started going to the House and the Senate, and went from there.
Mm-hmm. You said this would apply to, for instance, people who've been in prison for small amounts of illegal substances. How do we separate and make sure any dealers, for instance, being let out potentially through this legislation?
Well, I mean, there would be people that sold, to support their habit would certainly be left out. And but in terms of any people that were major dealers, they wouldn't be. They would have a crime that likely would not fit the criteria. And if somehow they did meet the criteria, it's very unlikely that they would be low risk, given their crime. Mm-hmm. And the parole board, as I said, I have a huge faith in the parole board. They're not going to let people out, even if they're eligible for this earlier release, if it doesn't make sense in terms of the safety of Iowans.
Can you give us an idea in numbers, approximate numbers, of how many people this may affect who are now in prison?
Well, I think the one set of numbers that I saw was it could affect 673 people that are in prison now. The estimate is that about 16% of them would be high risk. So that would leave about 563 that would be eligible. And the estimate is in the first year, 200 people would be let out of prison based on this legislation.
The legislation will become law once the governor signs it. Any reason to believe the governor will not sign it?
Well, I mean that's up to the governor. You can't really predict assume what the governor will do. He considers legislation very seriously. We're very hopeful that they will sign it. However,
mm-hmm. The bill also creates a new offense for third degree robbery. Can you explain that provision?
Yeah, that is something that you know wasn't a part of our set of proposals, and what I think that does is that provides that if in case of robbery, if the assault that took place as part of the elements required in robbery was a simple assault, you know, the basic, you know, simple assault, not aggravated in any significant way, then it would be a robbery third, and it would be an aggravated misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. I think what the legislature probably was trying to get at is that if someone has a minor scrape with a merchant or something and takes something, that it won't be a mandatory prison felony. It's an attempt, I think, to try and bring some justice to the kind of the factual situation that they're concerned about.
Another aspect of this legislation that I wonder if you can expand on is adding a mandatory minimum for intentional child endangerment resulting in the death of a child. I understand this. The impetus for this goes back to a four-month-old girl from Sioux City whose father fatally struck her, and turned out that he was almost immediately eligible for parole.
Yeah, I think that's the history, and this was something that took place before we were able to get involved with the sentencing reform provision that we had. It passed the House and then went over to the Senate, and then our proposal was attached to this, but. You know, I think you've got it right that when there's been a significant a child endangerment situation, there should be some sort of mandatory minimum, and that's what this legislation provides.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, this legislation deals a lot with mandatory minimums. What is the rethinking that you see going on, perhaps Iowa, in the context of the United States here, in terms of mandatory minimums on a state and federal level, and with other states? What do you see happening as a trend?
Well, I think there's, you know, been a lot of discussion throughout the country at the national level and the state level. And what's been interesting and I think really healthy is that it's been across party lines. You know, for instance, Senator Grassley has been very outspoken on it, as well as the Obama administration. And it's been also across ideological lines. It's something that that the NAACP has been very interested in, as well as Justice Action, which is a group that's primarily sponsored by the Koch brothers. So we have people, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives.
Mm-hmm. Why? Why though?
I think there's a recognition that there is some unfairness involved. That the mandatory minimum is very fixed and very inflexible, and a lot of people were being swept into that that shouldn't have been swept into to that that rigid formula. And also, I think that there's some recognition that the public money is being spent, huge amounts of it that need not be. One of the great figures and leaders on this in Iowa is David Roeder, the governor's head of management and budget. And, you know, he started from a point of view of the appropriations and the expenditures that were increasing. And he got, started to take a close look at it and started to see that, you know, that some of these years on the sentences of some of these individuals just didn't make sense. So it's been a sort of a number of people looking at it in terms of fairness and in terms of budgetary concerns. Everybody also, you know, is concerned about safety. Public safety is sort of the number one priority of a civilized state. So nobody wants to do something that would endanger in any significant way the public safety. So they're trying to balance fairness, budget, and safety in a way that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. What convinces you that public safety isn't sacrificed here? Because when this sort of tough on crime mandatory sentences, when they started to come into the picture in the 80s under the Reagan administration, for example, it was all about safety, and that by locking up people longer, we would be safer. That assumption is not proved true, or not true in all cases?
Not true in all cases, and particularly in the drug area. I think it was partly that we'd lock people up to make it safe, but also that we'd lock them up to get them off drugs. And once we started down that road, it wasn't working as well as we'd like. So the thinking was, well, we'll just make the sentences longer, and then maybe it'll work. And that was failed reasoning, I think. So the sentences got longer and longer, particularly for drug offenses, and that hasn't produced the drug-free society or approaching it like was hoped.
If you just joined us, Iowa's Attorney General Tom Miller is my guest, and he'll be with us for next few minutes. And we'll also be joined by Betty Andrews of the NAACP and Chip Baltimore, Representative Baltimore as well, weighing in on some measures that await the governor's signature, criminal justice reform, some significant steps that have been made at the Iowa legislature. Let me ask you this, Attorney General Miller. So you said 673 inmates this could affect being released over the next few years, not all at once, as they are reviewed by the parole board, for instance. Does Iowa have sufficient programs and resources to reintegrate, rehabilitate these offenders in society so we stay away from reoffending?
Well, I think we're doing better and better as we go along. And I think the recognition now is that for a lot of prisoners, particularly in the drug area, what we do in terms of reentry is much more important than how long the sentence is. So I think we're getting better. I think that drug treatment and drug courts are getting much more use and support, and that all makes a lot of sense. So I think we're doing better, but we have a ways to go. One of the things that I would like to see, and I think there's pretty good support for this, as we save money by this sentencing reform proposal, some of the money could be and I think should be used for the intense supervision of minorities, a program that's existing and works incredibly well. The recidivism rate is very low. So I think doing more of that would make sense in terms of safety and public policy, and would help with the issue concerning disparities as well.
Also joining you in the studio, Attorney General Miller, is Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska chapter of the NAACP. Betty Andrews, welcome back to our program.
It's good to be here again.
Also joining us by phone, Representative Chip Baltimore, chair of the House Judiciary Committee in the Iowa House of Representatives, a Republican from Boone. Representative Baltimore, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Betty Andrews, let's get your view on this. We talked a little bit at the front about reducing Iowa's disproportionate incarceration of minorities here. Give us your take on this legislation and how far it goes to answer that challenge.
Well, we certainly do believe that this legislation would be a step in the right direction. We, when we look at drug convictions, we know that there are, is a high percentage of African Americans that are facing those challenges. And so when we look at this legislation, although we'd certainly like to see a lot of things happen in terms of stepping in this direction, we do think that this will be a good step in the direction of reducing the disparity.
Mm-hmm. What about that idea of reoffending? How do we prevent that? Do you believe the state has the resources to reintegrate these people who have been in behind bars for years, perhaps?
I think that we have demonstrated that to some degree. Iowa has, in terms of some of the community-based corrections programming, and now the African American reentry rate is pretty much the same as the general population reentry rate. So I think that we have made strides in that area, and that has actually been in place for the last couple of years. So certainly we are, and I agree with Attorney General Tom Miller, that it is certainly a conversation and a process in terms of making sure we keep having these conversations and keep taking actions and keep really looking at how we can continue to get better. But there are a lot of people very interested in making Iowa better in this realm.
Mm-hmm. As these nearly 700, this projection of nearly 700 offenders are released potentially over the next few years, if this is signed by the governor, Betty Andrews, what will you be watching in that process as they go for review before the parole board? What are your chief concerns, your thoughts there?
Well, you know, and for us, obviously, the discretion is something that we want to look at. And one of the things that we have been really pushing in terms of working with the governor and with the chief justice in the juvenile system is making sure that there is adequate training in terms of implicit bias. And so when we're looking at the parole board having this type of discretion, making sure that they are culturally aware and that also that the assessment tool is culturally appropriate. And when we look at, you know,
what does that mean?
Culturally appropriate, meaning the assessment tool that they are using, that it doesn't have a disparate backlash toward communities of color.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of that?
Well, that's a really good question. There are a number, in the past there have been studies on certain tools in which there were opportunities to override a particular decision, and then also looking at certain backgrounds as a challenge. And so what we're hoping in terms of the tool, and we have been looking at several tools, but we're hoping that the tool would be strongly and come with a lot of research that says that it roots out some of the cultural challenges.
Mm-hmm. Chip Baltimore, let me ask you, we have to go to break in 2 or 3 minutes, but as the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, you voted for this bill, what convinced you it was a good bill?
Well, I think it started out with a lot of discussions that we were having amongst the legislators there in the House, as well as people involved in the criminal justice system in the months leading up to the legislative session. Over the last couple of years, I've served on the Public Safety Advisory Board, which is made up of representatives of county attorneys and law enforcement and parole officers and people from the Department of Corrections and people from all over the criminal justice system, and they had substantial discussions about mandatory minimum sentences and made some recommendations for some reforms, some of which we took a very, very strong look at and incorporated some provisions into the original bill that we sent over to the Senate this year, but also just trying to understand that in the criminal sentencing scheme, there is a hierarchy involved, and that we try to take the most severe offenses and treat them the most severely, and the most minor offenses and treat them relatively leniently, and we try to gradate those throughout the entire system. And I think this was a good effort to try to really readjust some areas where we saw some discrepancies in terms of the level of offense and the treatment that was being received in terms of a sentence.
How much of a role did the governor's words at the start of the year in the State of the State address, he talked about criminal sentencing reform, also Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady urging lawmakers to take a fresh look at criminal sentencing reform. How much did those words provide impetus, a push to legislators to say this is now the time to get this done?
Well, I've worked very closely with both the governor and Chief Justice Cady. Those words in those two speeches certainly were not specific in terms of here's what we would like to see the legislature do, but it certainly did indicate a willingness to consider the various concepts that we were going to consider throughout the session.
Mm-hmm. Because this was talked about in the previous legislative session, but it didn't get done then.
Well, it's not easy, I guess.
Right.
There's a lot of moving parts to this entire system, as I'm sure our other two guests could attest. And we wanted to make sure that we were doing it in a thoughtful manner, weighing all of the different ramifications of what we thought was necessary to do. And then you've got to get consensus on it, which is never easy when it comes to getting 51 representatives, 26 senators, and the governor all on board with the same basic concepts. So it just took some time.
Chip Baltimore and Betty Andrews, you'll be with us in the second half hour. We're going to say goodbye in a moment to Attorney General Tom Miller. Before you do leave us, Attorney General Miller, tell us where do we go from here? Where would you like to see it go from here? What still needs to be done?
Well, I think we brought together a great group of people that we're concerned about these issues, the Department of Corrections, the Parole Board, the Governor's Office, members of the House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, and groups like Betty's group and Justice Action and Families Against a Mandatory Minimum. So I think that there's a good working relationship. There's a victory that we all were happy about. So I think that to look at it further makes a lot of sense. But I think we've got time, and I think we need to be careful. Again, public safety is a very important consideration here that everybody is concerned about. But I'd like to recognize what was done by the legislators in this. They came together as Democrats and Republicans, members of the House and members of the Senate, and crafted this at a time when it looked like it was deadlocked. It looked like it wouldn't happen. But Chip Baltimore, the Judiciary Chair, was very important in this. Ken Reiser,
thank you very much. We have to go, Attorney General. Thank you so much.
I want to mention more people,
IPR.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow on this program, a wrap up of the Iowa Legislative Session. The 2016 session, a session we saw battles over the tight state budget and a failure of legislation making legislation to pay for water quality projects, also something that didn't happen this legislative session. Passage of some business tax breaks for stimulating economic growth. We'll talk about all those things and more with Bill Petrosky of the Des Moines Register tomorrow. Also, Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa. Who won, who lost, what passed, what failed? Tomorrow, legislative wrap-up on River to River. Today, we're talking about one particular aspect of legislation that passed, being called the most significant criminal justice reforms by the Iowa legislature in many years. Reform measures changing parole eligibility for nonviolent drug offenses, lessening penalties for nonviolent robberies. Something that's also supposed to help lessen Iowa's disproportionately minority prison population. Also establishing a mandatory minimum sentence for individuals convicted of child endangerment resulting in death. It's awaiting the governor's signature. Joining us for the rest of the hour, they were with us the first half hour, Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa Nebraska chapter of the NAACP, also Chip Baltimore, representative and chair of the Iowa House's Judiciary Committee, legislator, Republican from Boone. We hope you'll join us as well. Your questions, concerns, comments about these new criminal justice reforms. Does it make sense to you? Is it smarter sentencing? Is it likely to affect you? or a loved one. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go back to talk, Betty, a little bit more about this racial disparity. Iowa has the largest, for instance, racial disparity in the country of arrests in marijuana possession, blacks being more than 8 times as likely to be arrested than whites, even though whites use marijuana at about the same rate. This is according to the American Civil Liberties Union study. Tell us how this legislation, do you believe it will reduce the minority population in our prisons?
Well, obviously, with the numbers like that, 8.4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana. And so with numbers like that, it is and being number one in the nation at that, with that statistic, it will affect African-Americans significantly. And as that plays out, in the long run, African-Americans are percentage-wise convicted of drug crimes at a higher rate, again, despite the fact that usage is very similar. And then when we look at the mandatory sentencing among African American, 33% of mandatory minimum terms are African American. A lot of times we quote the number that we are about 26% of the criminal of the population in prison. But when we look at felonies, those numbers actually go up higher. So this type of legislation is very important to us in terms of reducing those numbers.
You were behind a bill. You wanted to see a bill passed that would eliminate some racial profiling that you saw. A bill passed that you wanted that mandated a collection of information about traffic stops. So does that relate to what we're talking about today, that you think perhaps needs to be on the agenda for the future?
Absolutely. That certainly is one of the aims of the NAACP. And, you know, we also understand that this is a process and that there are a number of things that we certainly pressed for during this legislative session that we will continue to press for. Our plan is to continue to cultivate the relationships and the information and help understand in terms of moving toward those goals. And when you think about the way that legislation can affect our state, I am the president of the Iowa and Nebraska NAACP. And in 2001, FBI statistics showed that Nebraska was worst in the nation in racial profiling traffic stops. In 2001, Nebraska did pass a racial profiling bill. And since then, they have dropped race, that has declined 51%. So that's a huge difference. And now Iowa, it being where we are in terms of ranking, we've had a 20 to 25% increase since 2001. And so looking at legislation, and this is why this is so important to us, because that piece of legislation changed the look of Nebraska. And we're hoping to do the same thing here in Iowa.
Betty Andrews of, as you just said, the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. Chip Baltimore, Representative Baltimore here with us, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and talking about criminal justice reform that awaits the governor's signature. Some aspects we've been discussing this hour. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Troy is listening in Iowa City. Hi, Troy. What are your thoughts? What's your question?
Oh, I got quite a few.
Just one, please.
Okay, how is it going to be letting out more people out of prison going to save money? Are they going to start closing prisons, or just the cost per inmate is going to go up?
Okay, Troy, we'll tackle that question right there. Chip Baltimore, where do the savings come from here? We have overcrowded prisons, for one thing, and we'll have fewer than inmates.
Right. That's always been a challenge for us to calculate the exact savings by having fewer prisoners. And Troy is exactly right. He makes a point that I have made a number of times in challenging some of the cost savings behind some of the proposals, in that the existence of a prison and the staffing of a prison is basically a fixed cost, whether you have it's 95% full or 105% full. There are some minor variable costs to that, but he's absolutely right. You know, the Attorney General's office in terms of some of their proposals came up with some cost savings figures. I think some of them may very well be accurate, but I think the main cost savings that I was able to see, not really calculate, but envision, is this bill only dealt with first-time offenders. And our hope is that by having first-time offenders be more serving their time in community-based corrections, getting drug treatment, that sort of thing, that they won't become repeat offenders, and then over time, our prison population will decline. That is certainly the cost, potential cost savings that I saw in terms of this possible concept.
Mm-hmm. And any savings, Representative Baltimore here? I think the Attorney General mentioned perhaps money's going toward more parole officers to better check these parolees.
Well, to the extent that we have more people on parole than in prison, then yes, I would imagine that either the existing parole officer caseloads are going to have to go up, or we're going to have a few more parole officers out there.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there a benefit, though, to having these people become productive tax-paying citizens? Isn't there, I mean, there a cost, I don't know if you would consider it a cost savings, but a positive financial outreach for our outlook for our state in terms of having them being able to work in the community and earn money instead of costing the taxpayers money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is absolutely one of our goals, without a doubt. It's impossible to try to calculate and turn that into some sort of number that we can depend upon, at least certainly not now. You know, maybe 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road into this system, we may be able to get a better handle on that. But right now, it's not something that we can calculate in terms of actual dollars to be saved.
But we know that if someone is in prison not earning dollars and versus being out of prison earning dollars, there is definitely right. going to be a benefit.
Well, that's true, assuming okay. that they are also, when they get out, they are employed. And they stay employed.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Again, our hope is that is where we get them to.
Right, and we want them to be employed in legitimate by legitimate means. Which these are mostly drug related offenses here. What about monies, Representative Baltimore? Our drug courts have been successful, but have been underfunded. Perhaps savings going towards drug courts or some other sort of drug treatments here.
You know, we've seen some successes in the drug courts, and again, that's a combination of the Department of Corrections, parole or probation officers working closely with the judicial branch in terms of making sure they're providing treatment and services to people with low-level drug offenses, trying to get them on a path to success. It's been challenging in terms of funding in some areas. It started out as more of a pilot project. We're trying to roll that out statewide, also trying to ascertain, especially in some of the lower populated counties and communities, you know, how much of a drug court service level we need. How do we staff that? It's more challenging in the more rural areas to do that than it is to do that in the more urban areas.
1-866-780-9100. A few more minutes with Representative Chip Baltimore, Chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Also, Betty Andrews of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. And we had a caller on the line that Dan had to go, but he was asking about tracking people closely to know if they're likely to reoffend. Representative Baltimore, the people that come out, are there any extra provisions to track them more closely than other parolees?
Well, I think we've got a number of safeguards put into this system with this bill, not only in giving the sentencing judge some discretion to set mandatory minimums based upon a validated risk assessment, but also the parole board as well and adopting that validated risk assessment. So before that decision is made, they've gone through a number of questions and analyses to evaluate their risk to offend. And then we are going to place a heavier burden on the parole officers or probation officers to make sure that that they're keeping track of how people are doing when they're not incarcerated. Obviously, the last thing that any of us want is to have someone be sentenced under this newer system and then go out and reoffend and land back in prison. I don't think there's anybody that wants that. We would love to see this have a great deal of success to take care of those first-time nonviolent offenders in these particular areas and go out and just and really be productive members of society that we're all hoping for.
Betty Andrews, back to the disparity that we see in Iowa prisons. Iowa, the largest racial disparity in the country in terms of arrests for marijuana possession and some other facts there that you were talking about earlier. This bill, hopefully, will reduce those disparities. But does it get at any of the root causes? What do you think those root causes are?
Root causes in terms of?
The fact that we have such a disproportionate number of minorities in our prisons when compared to our population.
Certainly. Well, I mean, if you look at other states and I know that there is some, sometimes people say we're at number one in terms of this disparity. Sometimes people say we're number two or number three. Well, the fact that we're at the top concerns us greatly. And we're not absolutely sure. What we do know is that African-Americans in Iowa certainly aren't any more troublesome than African-Americans in other places. And so we know that there are some statistical issues that some innate issues in terms of our criminal justice system that we do need to look at. And so that's what the NAACP has been doing in terms of watching how our state is equitably handing out sentencing and also how African-Americans are being brought into the criminal justice system.
1-866-780-9100. A few more minutes with Betty Andrews of the NAACP and Chip Baltimore, representative in our House of Representatives here in Iowa. Mark is with us, dialing in from Wisconsin. Mark, welcome to the program from out of state. What interests you about this discussion? You have some background concerning criminal justice?
Yeah, my background is a retired deputy warden at one of the penal institutions in Wisconsin. And my observations are, when I started in 1985, we had 4,500 inmates. When I left the Department of Corrections, we had 22,500. So it's almost a fivefold increase, which I think is deplorable. We incarcerate in the United States, I think everybody knows this, at a rate far higher than any other industrialized country. I think we went through a long period of time getting tough on crime. And there's a relationship between what it costs to build a prison versus what it costs to operate the institution. It's about, if it costs $45 million to build a prison, it generally will cost about one-third that on an annual basis.
Mark, we're losing you a little bit. But
reducing the number of institutions that we have.
Mark, you're on the road. I think we're losing you a little bit. Do you have a quick question before we lose you completely?
Development policy about building prisons, for economically disadvantaged areas. And when you look at the cost to operate an institution, you can see how pumping that kind of money into a community is a good thing. It's just not necessarily a good thing for society at large if you're increasing the budget. So while I would applaud Iowa and taking some initial steps, I think there's a long way to go. And one of those things that I think is very important is keeping people out of prison and spending some money on the front end to keep people out of prison. So with that, I'll sign off.
Okay. Thank you very much for your input. Mark from Wisconsin couldn't hear me respond to him, evidently, with that dodgy cell phone line. Anything to respond to there, Chip Baltimore? You were talking about the savings, potential savings. We have a lot of fixed costs here, don't we?
We do. We do. And our prisons are overpopulated right now based upon their recommended capacity. So, I don't expect to see a large savings associated with the bill that we just passed, if the governor signs it into law. But over time, I'm hopeful that we can either reduce the number of inmates that we need to have or see a slowdown in the rate of growth of the inmates, inmate population.
A couple of other aspects we haven't given much time to. Perhaps you could expand on this mandatory minimum sentence that was put in place for individuals convicted of child endangerment resulting in death. I understand there's a backstory to this. This is sort of an origin story for this legislation, Representative Baltimore, as I understand it.
Well, that's true. You know, this bill started out in the House as a simple bill that would have put into place a mandatory minimum sentence for child endangerment resulting in death of a child. That was co-sponsored by Representative Reiser and Representative Dawson out of Sioux City, and the bill was a response to the death of the child at the hands of the child's caretaker at the time, who was immediately made eligible for parole. As soon as he was sentenced. And, you know, as we worked that through the subcommittee and committee process through the House Judiciary Committee, we thought that this may be an appropriate vehicle to take a look at the mandatory minimum sentence structure for robbery second, which at the time, at least currently, has a seven-year mandatory minimum sentence if you're convicted of robbery second. And the Public Safety Advisory Board had recommended that we reduce that to 3 years. We thought that that was probably a little bit too ambitious for us. So what we did is we put into place a range for the sentencing judge to implement a mandatory minimum sentence anywhere between 3 years and 7 years. So we gave the judge the discretion to take a look at the particulars of each individual offense and the impacts on the victim and the potential threat to public safety, depending upon the level of the mandatory minimum sentence, using the risk assessments and the other opinions of the probation officers that are out there and Department of Corrections employees, and put that into place. So now we've got some flexibility in terms of the sentencing judge's ability to determine what that mandatory minimum sentence would be so that the punishment more appropriately fits the crime, if you will. When that went over to the Senate, that's when the Senate put the drug offenses into this. We had to make some additional changes when it came back to the House, but it kind of evolved from there. But it really was the result of a lot of discussions and a lot of very hard work and conversations between representatives and senators and Democrats and Republicans and governor's office, law enforcement, county attorneys. Everybody was involved in it as we tried to morph this, what was originally a very narrow bill, into something that was broader and hopefully more productive.
Okay. We have one more caller for this hour. Let's try to squeeze in Mario from Iowa City. Mario, I'm sorry, we just have a minute or so left, but I understand you. This is a topic very close to you. You were once incarcerated.
Yes, I was incarcerated. And what happened with me when I got out, I had so many supports put in place for me. I was released in 2001, and here it is in 16. I really think I'm doing great. But what I had in place for me, not to go back, was I had a support worker from the program I was in. My parole officer was on my side, and I was determined to get a job. And once I got that job, everything just started opening up for me. I felt like I was going to be able to make it out of here, but I had the support in place. And what happens is when these folks are released, there's not much support. Being in a box on an employment application, that's great. But when you go in and do the interview, what good is it going to do if they're going to still tell you no because of your background?
Okay.
So,
Mario, thank you for sharing, and we're so glad to hear your success story after being released.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Betty Andrews, can I hand it over to you for the last few words, perhaps for reacting to Mario's story and the way you see forward to improve?
I do want to congratulate Mario for his success. I did want to refer to the previous caller. He mentioned the prison population going up since the mid-80s. And the same thing happened in Iowa in terms of we are at least doubled, even more than double the amount of total prisoners. But in 1984, African Americans were 18.9% of the prison system, and now we're at 26% of the criminal justice system. And so that still remains our challenge with the NAACP. NAACP.
Betty Andrews, president of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP, thank you for coming into our studio today.
Thank you.
Representative Chip Baltimore, thank you very much for joining us by phone today.
Thank you so much for having me.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Also, thanks to John Pemble today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Mm-hmm.